do that first. Everybody, that chart, we've been at the same place for quite some time because, particularly the second and the third journeys, very lengthy, very involved, a tremendous amount of both doctrinal as well as historical information. And so wanting to be able to find that material, be able to reference that material, we've been working with this outline, assigning titles to each of these chapters just to help us find our way through them. So every week I give them to you in the same order. Do not call me mean. Every time you see this chart, you see the same chart in the same order. So I'm trying, hopefully, to help you remember these things. We always start every week. Chapter 3. What happened in chapter 3? Okay, Peter preaches his second sermon, lengthy sermon. And in chapter 8, the gospel goes to the Samaritan. So we have a lot of events there, the sorcerer, the Ethiopian eunuch, several of these conversions there. But primarily what you're thinking about is the gospel now spreading from Jerusalem into Judea and into chapter 8, the Samaritan region. Chapter 4. Okay, there's an arrest because they had healed the lame man. So now an opportunity for Peter's subsequent sermon, and therefore a third sermon. God has chosen him at the beginning of the book of Acts to be representative of the gospel that's being sent out. So he's the featured speaker also in chapter 2. But in chapter 1, we have an introduction. Jesus returns to reign from heaven. Matthias is chosen to replace Judas, who of course not just betrayed the Lord, but also committed suicide. In chapter 5, two people, Ananias and Sapphira. That's our first church problem. What kind of problem is it? It's a moral problem. They have failed to have the character that God asks of his people, and they are set forth then as an example of the furious wrath of God when you fail in that category. We don't have anybody being put to death for their sins again in the book of Acts or anywhere else, but we do have them set forth just so once you can understand how serious this is. If it can cost you your physical life in their example, what about your eternal life? Well, it's certainly at risk as well. So in chapter 2, church is established. Peter preaches his first sermon, and Peter's first, second, and third sermons then are all right in a row, chapters 2, 3, and 4. Chapter 6. Okay, choosing the 7. Yeah, it's a problem. What kind of a problem was it? So I'm calling it logistical, but it's a physical problem. It's a maintenance problem. It's an organizational problem. And so we have the choosing of the 7 to see that those widows are no longer overlooked. Chapter 7. Right. In chapter 7, we have Stephen's defense, which is in what form? What does Stephen do? It is a history of the Jews in the Old Testament up to the coming of the Jewish Savior or Messiah, who will also be the Savior or Messiah of the entire world. So, what price will he pay for this sermon? He will be the first to be put to death. Then in chapter 9, right, Paul is converted. What other places in the book of Acts do we read about Paul's conversion? 22 and 26. There will be three chapters where this will come up. We've only seen the one, chapter 9, be repeated in chapter 22 and 26 again. Chapter 10, Cornelius. Chapter 11, Cornelius. Chapter 12. Okay. Peter gets arrested again. It's an odd chapter. It's maybe the one I find the hardest to remember out of all of them. And Peter's arrested again. He had the death of Herod Agrippa, and so it's not kind of as cohesive a chapter as some of the others are. 13 is the first journey. 14 is the first journey. 15 is the I've got to get it up there. The Jerusalem Conference. As a result of these journeys, Paul's been preaching to the Gentiles. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, uttermost parts, Paul's out now. He's the apostle to the Gentiles. He's been eating with Gentiles, most notably what Gentile? Or, excuse me, Peter now. Peter ate with Cornelius. Now Peter has to answer for that to the apostles in chapter 15. And it's decided that with this third problem, what kind of problem was this? Doctrinal problem, we had a moral problem, we had a logistical problem, now we've got a moral, doctrinal problem, and it's resolved. Do Gentiles have to keep the Old Testament law? No. Do they have to offer sacrifice? No. The particular question you're dealing with in the chapter, do they have to be circumcised? No, they don't. Do you have to keep the Sabbath? Do you have to, do any of these things? No, you don't. What covenant are Christians under? The old or the new? Well, they're under the new covenant. So chapter 15 is where everybody gets on board. Paul is proven to have been chosen by God to be an apostle out of time, to have been filled with the Spirit, powerful miracle-working individual, preaching the same gospel that all the other apostles were, but taking it only that one necessary, as the Holy Spirit moved him, step into the Gentile world, now very fully and completely. And then there's no looking back from that point on. That'll always be the case. Chapter 16? Second journey. 17? Second journey. 18? Second journey still, right up to the end of the chapter, close to the end. Then we start the third journey, and now in chapter 19 we're still on the third journey, which spends most of its time in what city? Ephesus, which is the city that we're still in and going to be talking about here for the next few minutes. Also the way I set this up, and of course 28 chapters in the book, it fell out naturally anyhow. But you'll notice that over here to the far right-hand margin, in these first ones, you don't have any information that actually bumps that margin. But up here, looks like the Galatian letter would have been written during and immediately after the events of Acts 15, right in there. James may have been written, not mentioned in Acts, but may have been written in that time frame of chapter 16. We got 1 and 2 Thessalonians being written in chapter 18 during that second journey, and we're about to find out about 1 Corinthians here in our class tonight. So everybody come on over to chapter 19. And I say about to, we've already talked about 1 Corinthians being written, but that's where we're going to start this morning in verse 19:22. Having sent into Macedonia two of those who ministered to him, whose names are given, who are they? Timothy and Erastus. When did Timothy first show up on our radar? Well, just say what journey? First journey. Does he pop up on the radar again? Second journey. What journey are we on now? Third journey. Timothy shows up in all three journeys. He apparently becomes a Christian in the first journey. He becomes a servant of the Lord and a helper to Paul in the second journey, and is becoming a much more independent preacher in his own right now that we're on the third journey. So, at verse 22, he stayed in Asia, Paul did, for a while, but in the margin of your Bible, you should have written a date. What's the date? 57 AD. What's the season? It's probably springtime. Now, some will say as early as 55, so it's 55, 56, I'm fine with that. All dates are approximate. 57 is what I use. It's the spring of 57 when he writes what book? 1 Corinthians, and sends it back to Macedonia with Timothy / Erastus. So that's where this takes place. And then, coming to the map now, as we're on this second journey, this is 52, 53 A.D., in the second journey, Paul makes this giant circle. But in this second journey, has he gone into Ephesus itself? You see Ephesus on that map? Not outbound, but what? Okay, when he's coming back inbound at the end of that journey, he touched on Ephesus. He spent some time in Ephesus in the second journey, 52-53 A.D. Here comes the third journey. He starts out again in Antioch of Syria, not Antioch of Pisidia, but he starts off in Antioch again, and he's going through the same region he went through on which journey? First journey, and the second journey. And so, where Timothy was converted, he comes back to this region again. But now, here's where we are. He is in Ephesus. He's going to stay how long in Ephesus? 3 years altogether. We'll find out in chapter 20. And he writes 1 Corinthians. So, a little bit, and a lot faster, because he spends most of his time in his journey there, he's going to head on up through territory he did in the second journey, all territory he did in the second journey. This time, instead of sailing home in kind of a big circle, he's going to backtrack. He hasn't done it yet, but he will. And we're going to go through it very rapidly, as the scripture does. And the next time he gets down in this region, does he go to Ephesus itself in chapter 20 when we get there? Do you remember? No. He calls the elders from Ephesus to him and Miletus, and then he's going to sail back and wind up in Jerusalem, where he will be arrested. Okay, so his journey is going to come to an end for a while, at least free journeying. And so it's about 54 through 58 A.D. that this journey is taking place. Nice long journey, probably 5 years anyway, I would guess. And then if we zoom into this part of it where we are right now, Paul has come through this region, went through the high country, as it said in verse 1, I think it is, and comes to Ephesus. This is where we are. It's another one of these profoundly central, wealthy, influential cities in what empire? In the Roman Empire. Now, before we get into the verses themselves, just take you to this theater, of course. Everybody knows about this riot, 2 hours, great as Artemis of the Ephesians and all that. You've seen many pictures of this through the years, and I've given you dozens of them probably. There's a great aerial shot right there. Please note that this one is better preserved than most because, for instance, unlike the Roman theater at Caesarea Maritima, which is a perfectly freestanding theater, what's this one? You see here especially how it's been built into the hillside. So it's had better protection, better support through the ages, and you can see you've got three whole levels right here that are preserved. Caesarea has lost the first 1.5, that its top layers have crumbled down. And then also I want you to take notice of all of this right here. It's just to be a much taller structure. We'll talk about that, some more. And then you can see there are more structures over here that began to come away from the hillside to be more freestanding, and so they eroded on down, and we're losing the the visibility of the substructure there. So here's another shot. Now note, here we're up in the stands, and you can tell just above the first, section there. So the two more that would be up above the location where this photographer's standing, about the middle of the second, I guess. But as you look out in the distance, it's really pretty, isn't it? And even prettier as you turn to look in other directions. Would you have been able to see those mountains from these lower seats? No. Why? Because of this structure down in here. So it's just, that not even the whole first floor, is there, but we'll talk about that in just a second. So once again, if you're high enough, you would be able to see really pretty countryside, a wonderful, wonderful location there, so a great place for theater. And now as we start to just zoom in a little bit more closely, Paul was not present, you'll recall. He wanted to go down there. His friends were down in there. Everybody's writing. They want to kill him even down in there. Imagine 10,000, 20,000 people that could sit here. And as you come down to the bottom there, apparently these poor guys had been hauled in and they're facing this entire gigantic assembly. They're on that pavement. These are apparently the paving stones, and their view would have been something like this, totally filled with the residents of this city who are crying for their blood. So you'd sure feel small, wouldn't you? They had, they're only brand new Christians, so they haven't had a lot of time to be fortified or doctrinally informed. And now, here is an artist's conception of a different location. So bear in mind, this is not somebody saying what Ephesus looked like based on the ruins we have. It's not that. It's just a typical Roman theater. But see how elaborate it was. See the immense wealth that goes into it. See how they would have many different rooms and balconies where the singers and the actors could do their plays and presentations. In some of these theaters, in the one in Caesarea was this way, they had this main stage, you know, platform area, and this lower part right here had all been waterproofed so they could fill it with water and have mock Navy battles and stuff that they could play out there, you know, so they could even do sea scenes. And so it's magnificent, but once you're inside here, where'd the mountains go? See, I don't have any mountains. By the way, could it get pretty hot in there? Whew, you could really get baked, and so this one doesn't show it, but they also had elaborate ropes and pulleys that would allow them to pull fabric across the top to produce shade as well. So they had retractable roofs, just like our football players today, you know, even back then. Now, once again, I just want you to get the lay of the land here. This is not Ephesus, but it was the best preserved facade that I could find. And you'll note, this is not a very thick or, you know, elaborate one anyway. But it does give you a better idea of one that's been preserved and how very enclosed that you would be. So try to imagine, you know, you're one of the guys that got hauled down in there, you know, you're all standing outside listening to the roar of this stadium crying for blood, and, you know, it's just not a good moment in Acts chapter 19. This, again, brings us back to Ephesus, and we'll leave this up as we now come down to verse 35. In verse 35, we looked off at 34. They've been chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," been doing this for 2 hours. In 35, after quieting the multitude, the town clerk said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there, after all, who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is guardian of the temple of the great Artemis?" Now, this is a theater where they are. It's not the temple. But we're the guardians. You know, that's our god. Artemis, also called Diana, and the image which fell down from heaven. Now, brothers, we understand it, and I'm not quite so sure about this one, but it is thought that there had been an actual meteorite that had you know, descended, and then they dug this up and took it as a sign from the heavens, and whether or not they carved an idol out of it and that sort of thing, I'm really not sure, but it's possible at least that that's what they're talking about when they say it fell from heaven. And so, guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of the image which fell down from heaven. Since then, these are undeniable facts. You ought to keep calm and do nothing rash. For you brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples. See, they haven't stolen any of our votive offerings. Nor blasphemers of our goddess. Now, that's very interesting. Does Paul or the Christians of the first century have any affinity for idolatry at all? They really don't. But what happened in Athens, as Paul began his speech in Athens, was he just flying in their faces and railing about how stupid it was to, you know, be an idolater? Well, he rather started respectfully. So you're very religious. Got an altar over here, an unknown god. So here's what I'll do. I'll tell you about that one. Okay? Now over here, this guy, if it wasn't true what he's saying, and you're looking at 20,000 people in the stands, and you say something that is not true and just happened 2 hours ago, you're going to be in pretty serious trouble. So it's true. They're not robbers of temples, and did they blaspheme Artemis of the Ephesians? No. Probably never mentioned her. No need to. So, in 38, if Demetrius and the craftsmen who are with him, you remember them, what craftsmen, commodity did they work with? Yes, they were silversmiths. Okay. Demetrius and these silversmiths who are with him have a complaint against any man, the courts are in session. Proconsuls available. Let them bring charges against one another. Well, so let's just do this way. Legally. Just calm down and do this legally. Oh, by the way, the guy, I believe, is no dummy. Now, brethren, you know, I don't know the last time you went to a good football game. I know who to turn to find out. When you go into a big stadium, Diane, does anybody ever chant anything? Sure, you can always hear anything that you do. Could you chant without stopping for 2 hours? Diane said four. I thought she was going to say no. Now I don't know how to go on with my class. Yeah. Well, usually, don't you stop and wait for the next play? And then you shout again. Okay? So, yeah, 2 hours, though. At the end of 2 hours, does Diane just come leaping and bounding out of there even if you win? Or are you pretty well winded? When did this guy choose to say, we're in deep trouble here? How long did he let it go on? 2 hours. He's a town clerk. This is a guy with a lot of power. This is also a smart guy. And he's afraid of what was a very real and terrible danger. So he says, let them bring charges against each other. Now look at 39. But if you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly. For indeed, we are in danger of being accused of a riot in connection with today's affair, since there's no cause. And in this connection, we shall be unable to account for this disorderly gathering. And after saying this, now looking at the rest of the verse, did he convince everybody that that was so? Well, if he dismissed the assembly, what did the assembly do? Well, they left. So apparently they went, oh yeah, I mean, that's right. So now in the Roman Empire, if there's a riot, there's two groups of people going to be in really serious trouble. Who's the first group? The ones pitching the fit. Who's the second group? The ones that did not put it down. When you have a riot, isn't there often property destruction? Okay? People just run amok. They'll destroy, you know, their own neighborhoods. We see it all the time every time there's a riot. Has Rome spent a pretty penny here? Throughout this town. Okay? They have, that is the Roman Empire, they have a vested interest in keeping the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. They're exceptionally proud of it. It is an infinitely valuable thing. We just prayed about it a moment ago. We have the Pax Americana. And it's great, isn't it? You feel relatively secure. Certainly more so than other countries. And anytime anybody starts getting feisty like this, that news hits Rome in a hurry and comes back sometimes even faster. So, this city clerk knows it's not just his job that's on the line, but potentially what? His life and half of the existing government, and certainly everybody that's in that stadium right now. So he waits for 2 hours, and then he says, hopefully, you know, all of them not with the lung power of Diane over here, would, you know, by 2 hours be tired. Say, okay, yeah, all right. We'll just settle down here. So the assembly's over. Does anybody get killed? Does anybody get hurt? No. A lot of people made fools out of themselves. The Christians were left alone. And in verse 1, the uproar ceased, chapter 20. And after it did, Paul sent for the disciples, and when he had exhorted them and taken his leave of them, he departed to go to Macedonia. Well, he's the big ringleader instigator, but he's perfectly free to move on. So the town clerk saved the day, and everybody went home. Christianity remains. Now comes verse 2. Highly significant along with verse 3. So get your pencils and pens out again. He went to Macedonia. So what did he do? He crossed over like he did when he had the dream of the Macedonian calling, come over and help us. He continued in a westerly direction, probably from the port of Troas like before, sailed across, to Macedonia. And then it says in verse 2, when he had gone through those districts, Macedonia, and had given them much exhortation, he came to Greece, and there he spent 3 months. When a plot was formed against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia. So he changed his plans. He was going to take a boat. He was going to go back to Syria, just like he'd done in the last half of his second journey. But circumstances changed, so he didn't. And instead, he retraced his path and went back north again. Now, with the word Macedonia in verse 1, next to that verse, that's where he writes 2 Corinthians. He's in Macedonia when he writes 2 Corinthians, apparently. And then in verse 2, during the 3 months that are mentioned in verse 3, but while he's now in Greece, he writes the Roman letter also. So first comes 2 Corinthians, and then the Roman letter. And it is, for both letters, 57 or 58 A.D. 57 or 58 A.D. I can't help you with the season on this one. Okay, so back to the... here it is. I went too far. Let's get this up. Okay, back to the map there. So, Paul has come through, same way he went in the first two journeys, so he gets to Ephesus and, quite out of his past habit, stays for 3 years and writes 1 Corinthians. Then he apparently comes up here to Troas and he heads across into Macedonia, where he writes 2 Corinthians, individual cities not being named. And then he comes on down here to Corinth, apparently, where he writes the Roman letter in verse 2. 2 Corinthians up in Macedonia somewhere, likely Corinth, here in Achaia, slash Greece, also known as Greece. And there, he would have set sail. No, better not. So with the red now, he goes right back through all this same region. Chapter 20, verse 1. After the uproar, in what city? Ephesus. Head seat. Paul sent for the disciples, exhorted them, took his leave, went to Macedonia and wrote what book? That Corinth, what year is it? 57 or 58. When he'd gone through those districts, given them much exhortation, he came to Greece. And in the next 3 months that are mentioned in verse 3, what's he do there? He writes Romans. And what is the likely year? 57 or 58. When a plot was formed against him by the Jews, as he was about to set sail for Syria, he determined to return through Macedonia. And he was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, of Pyrrhus. They add, as you can see, the son of Pyrrhus, but that is the way they do that. So Pyrrhus was his dad. And by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and of Gaius and Derbe and Timothy, and Tychicus and Trophimus of Asia. Okay, so on this map, while we don't any longer really think of it this way, this region right here today is all called Turkey. In biblical times, it's called Asia. And typically, to distinguish it from the Asia of today, we call it Asia Minor. Okay, Asia Minor. What's this region up here on the north end of the Aegean Sea? Macedonia. Name for me a couple of cities in Macedonia. Philippi. Paul's already written two letters to one of those cities up in Macedonia. First and Second Thessalonians. Okay? Can't think about Thessalonians without thinking about the Bereans. So he's back through territory that he was in on his second journey. And now for what will be the third time. Second journey, circle, third journey twice. Now he's retracing. He's coming back to cities that he knows very well. He's known for years. Spent time with them. And so he's accompanied by people, Gaius, Timothy, and all the rest that he's picked up on this journey coming through the first part, through Turkey, modern Asia Minor. where, of course, he'd been on a previous journey as well. So, in 6, we sailed from Philippi, excuse me, 5, but these had gone on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. And we, why do I emphasize the we? Who's back on the tour? Luke. So circle the we, and then draw a line out, an arrow, you know, put Luke rejoins Paul. So he may have been Luke years there. But now, you know, from the second journey, now he's going to travel with Paul again. So we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, came to them at Troas in 5 days. There we stayed 7 days. You know, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul began talking to them, intending to depart the next day, and he prolonged his message until midnight. Brother, I'm an equal opportunity offender. You know I am. One of, I think, the poorest arguments that we as Christians have ever made is right here in these verses in chapter 20. Is there a single word in this verse that says anything that would prove that Paul waited in that town so he could partake of the Lord's Supper? There is not. How we got started with that, who started that, I don't know. But in my view, if I could just be harsh to make the point, I think it's just pathetic that we've made that argument. It does not say so at all. Now, I'm going to find out that something happens on the first day of the week. But when it says in verse 6 that he stayed for 7 days, does it tell you why? No. Is it fair to assume and then build a cardinal doctrine about when we are to have our assembly and partake of the Lord's Supper? Is it right of us to make what is for a lot of people their primary argument that the Lord's Supper should only be taking place on the first day of the week, and this verse proves it? Paul waited 7 days so he could. There is absolutely no justification for that. And in fact, there is a great deal more justification for my telling you that I know why he stayed those 7 days. You know why he stayed those 7 days? Because he was waiting for a boat to get on. That's why he stayed. And my argument is just as justifiable as yours, because it doesn't say, does it? But my argument is a good deal more reasonable. Who controls the ships in the Mediterranean? Is it Paul? No. And do they leave at 3 p.m. every afternoon? No. Okay. So we've been rolling into this passage, you know, as if Paul always carried a shipping schedule in his back pocket. He'd say, well, you know, there'll be 6 boats leaving, you know, as if it were an airport or something. And we just imposed our own kind of sensibilities on this, and then just out of the clear blue sky decided that Paul waited 7 days so he could partake of the Lord's Supper, and he skipped all those other boats. There is no argument to be found in these verses that he waited 7 days so he could partake of the Lord's Supper. Okay, so did I break that argument? Let's not do that anymore. Now, if you're mad at me, that's fair. You know, come and show me about it after class. Don't do it here, because if you prove me wrong, I'll be so embarrassed. I don't think you can. So we just don't want to overextend ourselves. We sometimes get overeager, and when we do, and people see that, and they are more reasonable than we are, and your Seventh-day Adventist looks right down into that, and he says, well, you guys are cracked. And therefore, everything I teach on the Sabbath is right, because you just made a bad argument. That's what they do. Is it fair? No. Is it right? No. Does my bad argument prove that their worst argument is true? No. But shouldn't I not give them grist for their mill? I shouldn't do that. So, you read those 2 verses now, everybody. Look very carefully and tell me, why did Paul stay there for 7 days? Greg, I told y'all, he's asking these people, where's the verse that tells us that? Okay, we talked about that off the record here before the class. Does the verse tell us why he stayed?
No, it does tell us what happened 7 days later. Carl?
This appears to have an example in writing.
Oh, there's an example. I'll get to that now. You're absolutely right. Now, when did he partake of the Lord's Supper? Apparently on the first day of the week. They gather together to break bread, and that sounds like that would be the Lord's Supper. I think it's the Lord's Supper. Other passages would indicate first day of the week, Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 16 has an absolutely ironclad argument for why you should meet on the first day of the week and therefore partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. But this isn't 1 Corinthians 16. Okay? So I'm not going to take the time to get into it, but Carl's right. I mean, there is an example, but the example is not Paul stayed there 7 days so he could partake of the Lord's Supper. He skipped all the other boats because he wanted to partake of the Lord's Supper. That's the argument we've made. That cannot be sustained by these verses. But Carl's absolutely right, and I am too, I'm sure, that this is the Lord's Supper, and it is on the first day of the week. Paul began talking, intending to depart the next day. He prolonged his message until midnight. Long time there. No wonder he's leaving, so spend a lot of time. And in verse 8, there were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered together. A certain young man named Eutychus, sitting on the windowsill, sinking into a deep sleep. And as Paul kept on talking, he was overcome by sleep, fell down from the third floor, and was picked up dead. Paul went down, fell upon him, and after embracing him, said, "Do not be troubled, for his life is in him." And when he had gone back up, broken the bread, and eaten, he talked with them a long while until daybreak, and so departed. They took away the boy alive and were greatly comforted. Now, I don't think this needs any comment whatsoever. Could Paul work the miracle of raising the dead? Apparently so. It's been done before. So it's just another proof. Let me race on. I got carried away in my class today. But let's go to 13. We going ahead to the ship, set sail for Assos, intending from there to take Paul on board, for thus he had arranged it, intending himself to go by land. When he met us at Assos, we took him on board and came to Mytilene. Then in 15, sailing from there, we again arrived the following day opposite Chios, next day Samos, day following Miletus. Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus in order that he might not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem if possible on the day of Pentecost, which, by the way, suggests to me back in verses 6 and 7 that it was a shipping schedule that kept him there. He was in a hurry. And in this case, he's going to skip Ephesus. Where does he spend more time than any other city ever? Ephesus. And he's skipping them so that he can get back in time. Well, you suppose he would skip 6 days then if he could just take a boat anytime he wanted? Don't believe so, brethren. He's in a hurry. So he wants to be there on the day of Pentecost. And from Miletus, he sent to Ephesus and called to him the elders of the church. When they came to him, he said, and that we'll pick up next week. So here's the deal. Ephesus, 3 years. Fairly quick journey through a lot of region and activity. Second Corinthians, Romans, turns around, comes back, sends guys ahead, waits in the port, finally ships off. Luke joins him, comes back. Here's Assos right here. Comes down through this region, Middle East, Chios is an island, Samos is another, and he hits Miletus. Just a few miles, almost due south from Ephesus itself. But you know, it's a fair journey. And Paul knows, if I go to Ephesus, what'll happen? How many people will want him to stay? It's absolutely everybody, and it's going to be hard. So I can't get into that. It's just going to be too much. So he sends a runner. Go on, get up there to Ephesus and tell them to meet me at Miletus. And so they come down to this little seaport right here, and there we're going to have the rest of chapter 20 and Paul's very important sermon that takes place in Miletus. Okay? Any other comment or question? Carol?
It would have been faster to send a runner and have them come than it would have been for him to have to travel there and back, even if he just met with the elders.
You know, that's exactly right. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if exempt were, you know, somehow sooner. And again, talking about shipping and all of that, he may have had a schedule that he knew about. I mean, these guys did that. It's not like they have the internet, but, you know, here's Middle East. He's got to come through here. And, you know, they may be stopping in each of these different places. It might have been faster from Troas for him to send somebody down ahead of him so that they would be waiting for him at Miletus. But I don't know. So when did he send ahead? How did he send ahead? You know, I can't tell you. But either way, Paul knew, I need to avoid Ephesus. There's too much love. And if I get in there surrounded by all of that, they're not going to want me to leave. It's going to be painful for everybody. It's going to be painful for me. And I might get hung up, you know, maybe problems that I just really wouldn't feel like I had to deal with. I've got business. You know, I've got to go.